The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia L. Khoury. And today on The Parents Show, I'm really pleased to be joined by Chris and Elsa, who are from The Dogs and Birds Piano Method. Now, I bet you're as curious as I am about The Dogs and Birds Piano Method, and I'm even more excited about meeting Chris and Elsa. Hi, Elsa. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Oh, hi, Lydia. Hi. Everybody.
I'm fine too.
Right.
So I'm sure our listeners are dying to know what the Dogs and Birds Piano Method is. So tell us where the idea came from, Chris.
Well, the idea came from Elsa. The idea is that it's a piano method that's been developed to be accessible for very young children. So these children, maybe as young as three, as old as seven or older, especially when they're very young, their brains are developing, they're learning languages, and it turns out that the language of music is something that they are very capable of taking in, soaking up. Sometimes they can't colour in a drawing or anything, but they can actually play beautiful music and they can sing. And by doing it at this very, very young age, it can be incredibly beneficial for them. For example, in preparation and support for schoolwork later on.
Elsa.
So practically, I'm Hungarian, as you can hear, but the music is an international language, and games and toys are internationally accepted language, especially between children. So my job was very easy when I was suddenly dropped around the millennium in a school where I had to face very, very young children as age 3, 4, 5, daily, every day I had to train them to learn the piano, and then I didn't want to be a babysitter. So I wanted them to learn, not just look after them in the school, especially because previously I was teaching much higher level. So I was frustrated. I couldn't communicate. I couldn't pass my knowledge to the children. And I was based in a Kodai method, my teaching based always on the Kodai method coming from Hungary. I started to teach based on singing, but the technical problem was to find the children proper hand position, figure out the proper hand position, because anatomically they weren't ready to play properly, and to navigate themselves, to find themselves the geography on the piano. So that's why I experimented for 2 years with different type of toys and even fruit, family members, everything. And finally, actually, after 2 years, came together the basic of the foundation, the concept of Dogs and Birds. Children clicked with the animals, and it was very easy to understand between the two black keys, the dog. So straight away on the first lesson, they learned 7 notes from the piano, all the dog. So practically, this was the beginning of Dogs and Birds around 2000.
Maybe, can I say, so the animals are actually cat, dog, egg, fish, goose, and bird. So see, well, I can't say it in letters, but usually letters are used conventionally, but it's hard for a child to distinguish between a C and a B and a D, but they understand cat, dog, egg, fish, goose, and bird. And they're monosyllabic so that they can sing each note. So they sing cat every time they play a cat. They sing bird every time they play a bird. And that helps to reinforce the notes in their minds. And it also helps to give them a good, very good musical ear. It turns out that there's some theory suggests that maybe you're born with perfect pitch, but you lose the ability. But quite often, a lot of ELSA students have very, very, well, maybe not perfect pitch, but because they're always singing the animal names as they play, they can really, well, almost develop perfect pitch, if you like, or retain it, possibly is a better word.
Yes.
Fantastic. It's such a lovely, lovely idea. And I have to say, you know, the idea of three-year-olds sitting at a piano and the kind of the use of animals to bring out their musicality is so lovely. It's really, really lovely.
Maybe I should add, at that age, parental support is very, very important. If they can understand the difference between two black keys on the piano and three black keys on the piano, then in principle, they're ready to start. But they do need parental or support from a help.
Partner.
Yes.
Partner. They need a partner. Doesn't necessarily the parents, you know, the older sibling, the grandmother, the childminder, anybody, a partner, especially, you know, is excellent for parents and children bonding, but it is excellent for grandparents as well. And especially if one child starts to learn in the family, then the younger is ready, like the younger always want to copy the older one. So practically it's coming a family game, and then we designed like a win the tires, like a card game, who can recognize the pitch earlier and then who will be the winner. Or similarly, throw the draw and then on the large stakes, and who can read faster what is the animal who lives on the line or on between the lines, the space.
And usually the children will beat the adults.
Yes.
So that's...
Ah.
They learn much faster at that age.
Oh, that's so, so lovely. Now, a little bird told me that there are puppets involved. Can you talk to me about your use of puppets? Why puppets?
Well, Elsa will tell you. Well, I will tell you what Elsa would say. I mean, puppets just inspire the children. Children love puppets so much. And the way they arrived is that our tutor books are illustrated in full colour with all of these animals. The animals then became, I think, probably finger puppets. And then the animals have come into these videos that we have been producing. So that's where they came from. Basically, the puppets inspire the children. That's the main reason. And the two puppets in the films we've made are Dorian the dog, who's a student. He's learning the piano from Miss Bell, who sounds a bit like Elsa, actually. The piano teacher, she's the bird.
Oh, I wish our listeners could see now. I could see, oh, the puppets are so cute, so, so lovely. The kids must really get engaged. Elsa, is there great excitement in the classes?
Of course, because, for example, if a child comes the first time, you know, they try to hide behind mommy or try even don't come close to you because it's a completely new environment. But as soon as you get the puppet and you hide behind the puppet or the puppet invites them to come closer to the piano, tapping together, improvising together, singing together, they do anything and everything for the puppets. Anything and everything for the puppets, because these are the element, the daily toy and games, and then they straight away click into a mood which relaxing them with the toys and then with the puppets, and then they teach the puppet, they learn from the puppet, they improvise with the puppet. So practically you can do anything with the puppets.
Puppets are just magic.
Yes, but the puppets came later. First, we find the animals. The animals were important to call the letters. So that was, first of all, important to recognize a key. The puppet wasn't ready. The key, the D note on the piano, we called a dog. The B notes, we called a bird. And the puppet just came after that when I said, all right. They call it dog, but it's much better if I have just a dog. And then look at that, these are the doggies live on the piano. So, and then the film turn with the film, the dogs and birds puppet videos are 91 lessons, what you can follow. And that was the idea came to make a puppet film, which they can use at home around,
especially with practice,
2010, when parents really want to see how is my child? Is my child ready to learn? He's always singing. It would be so nice to do something at home, train. And then I thought, yes, actually, if a child asks me, Mommy, how should I draw an elephant? Then you don't take your child to a special art teacher to teach to draw that elephant. Exactly the same. If the mom wants to teach the child a little bit of basic music, then the film is ready to use at home with the child. And practically, it is that's why I thought help for the parents to use it at home and have fun at home. And if the child is interested in, then we go further and invest on proper piano lessons.
Oh, I see. That's a fantastic idea. So how far can a child get with the dogs and birds piano method?
So with the film, what we made ready just during COVID, it was quite old. So anyway, 5 children, all of them are under age 4. 5 children actually demonstrate what Dorian the puppet learns with Miss Bell, because the hand position, the body position, and the singing.
He doesn't have fingers.
Yes, so it's important. So we cover book 1 when practically with the film, 91 piano lesson, 16 hours. That is good for a base for at home to learn with mom and or daddy or anybody. But after that, we recommend to go to start with a piano teacher if the child shows interest. So in end of book 1, they learn basic. They know all the piece, all the notes on the piano. They read the 8 notes or fish to fish. So F to F cover an octave, but they know the the piano, all the notes, and then the improvisation, the rhythm, the singing already very matured and has a strong foundation.
Actually, can I just add, they learn both treble and bass clef at the same time. They play the dog with their right, their red hand, and they play the bird with their blue left hand. So straight away they start to learn all of the geography of the keyboard, not just learning treble clef first and then bass clef first. So that is, again, for them, their mind, that is very important.
And on that, Chris, I mean, can children go on to read music, to potentially even take piano exams? Where does it lead to?
Well, yes, I mean, I think what we say it's an important part of this particular approach. I mean, that they do lots of musicality. They do improvisation, which is making noises on, well, from our improvisation is making noises on the piano, but they do really learn to read music, and they do that from day one. We have tiles which they can put on with animals in, which they can put on the keys on the piano, and they can put on some musical staves. And so they really learn that from the beginning, but that's part of it. So they are really learning how to read notation, even at that very basic level. They can't possibly read the alphabet, but there aren't quite as many notes and combinations that they need to understand. But this is something that they can do.
That's wonderful. I mean, and I think the thing that I love and that comes across from what Elsa and you are saying is the musicality. It's the love of music. And that's what you're tapping into, that kind of innate love of music and developing it. And no amount of, I mean, there are children who can go through years of piano lessons who actually never really get that musicality, because there's sometimes a bit too much of a focus on exams.
Musicality is the main thing, I think, especially when they're singing as well. We probably sometimes people aren't so comfortable with singing, but it really is quite important for giving a whole sort of musical picture for the child.
Yes, and because I came from Hungary, and there is the musicality. So even when you learn the piano, parallel, you really need to have a musicianship lesson. So you can't learn just the piano. So it's so important, the singing, the tapping, the marching. So practically, later on in book 2, they start to use 2 other new method which helps them to play, to conventional music, like they start to use, like in England, you use the FACE, the face notes, to read the treble clef. But for example, we are introducing, the first line is every, the third line is bird, and the fifth line is flies. So carry on with the bird. Every bird flies, and pianistically, just a step or a skip from these notes. So they straight away can read the whole staves.
All dogs growl, going in the opposite direction.
For the bass.
For the bass. But yeah. Something we haven't actually said is that there are two versions of the tutor books. One we call the animal notes version, which has little animal symbols in the notes. And one, the blank note version, doesn't have the little symbols in the notes. So that for the very young, they can read the animals initially, but almost straight away, Elsa moves all of her students to the blank book. So they, even the three-year-olds, so they
need both of one.
There are illustrations in the book which help the children to know where each animal sits on the musical staves.
Fantastic. Can I ask you, you have probably worked with quite a number of students and probably quite a wide range of students. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that's been? Who have you worked with? Where have they gone? I'd love to hear a little bit about your experience.
Well, to be honest, Elsa is probably the better person to say this, but a lot of the students are excelling academically. They've been to music colleges, Trinity College, Guildhall, Purcell School, some Oxford. There's an organ scholar at Oxford at the moment that started with dogs, but they don't all go to Oxford to become organ scholars. But and professionally, there's scientists as well. So in general, we feel it is a good, if you like, educational background for the children.
And it is very important. We always forget the importance of music. But actually, music is so important emotionally. So you can't be a big scholar if you are not healthy emotionally and you are not balanced in your personality. So practically, it already giving a big opportunity to be healthy, mentally healthy, which is so important today.
I think we couldn't agree more. And your both of your enthusiasm and energy is so infectious, and that's so good for mental health as well, isn't it, to have the kind of positivity that you both bring. So parents can, it can be anybody, but a companion is needed for the younger children. So can you bring it to life for us? So is there clapping, games, singing? So is the parent involved? I mean, if yes, that must be such a lovely bonding experience.
Yes, actually, the funniest game and the favorite game of the children when the parents play pretending games. And I do that on the lesson as well. Yes, so the children, even when they are very tired, so for example, the video and the whole method is based on five big columns, like finger exercises, reading the pieces, doing improvisation, rhythm exercises, and the fifth one, what did
you say? Ear training?
Ear training, that's always the singing and recognizing, yes. So practically, these are the elements, and then we recommend to do daily practice. And with the daily practice, you should do two elements. You can't cover everything, it's too many things. Just two elements, and when the child losing interest, then you are teaching the puppet, and you just listen, who is better, the puppet or me? The mother can say that. Oh, you are testing us. So the boy is testing, or the child is testing the mother, and that is an excellent game to pretend, and who is better, who is weaker, marching or dancing or doing the improvisation with finger puppets. Lots of improvisation where we learn different techniques, especially body, for loosening the arms and get the correct body position, learning different dynamics for rhythms, full of improvisations for the children. And obviously, the book has a story as well. So when they play the pieces, they should read the storyline and talk about the pictures, which is wonderfully illustrated by Mark Chambers. And then you just need to put up the question, who, why, where, what, when, and then straight away, the child can come back and we can carry on. Right, well, yeah.
Maybe can I just emphasize a bit in this pretending that Elsie talks about? The child is learning as much by spotting the mistakes, if you like, as understanding that everything's correct. They learn as much. It's often quite fun as well.
Brilliant. If
purposely makes a mistake and think, oh no, that's not that, that's wrong, are you sure, or something like that.
Lovely. So, I mean, Elsa and Chris, you've got such a lovely concept, a lovely idea here, and parents can avail of it. So they can, there are puppet videos, books, puppets and tiles, and they come as a bundle. How can parents buy them? How can they find out more about the lessons? Do you have websites? How can we get in touch?
Well, our website is www.dogsandbirds.co.uk. People still ask whether there's an ampersand, but you're not allowed to have ampersands in URLs. So that's the URL. And our email is info@dogsandbirds.co.uk as well. Not with that thing as well. And we have something called a puppet video bundle, which includes the videos, the two versions of book one, the tiles and staves, and little Dorian and Miss Bell finger puppets. So that's one thing we might recommend, but everything's available individually as well.
And the lessons, practically, there are registered Dogs and Birds teachers, because we have teachers' courses as well. And the parents, depends on how much time the parents have or the helper. If somebody has time to invest and go through the videos, and as soon as the child wants to play, let's do it and copy Dorian, imitate the way he's singing or learning. Or if that doesn't work, then they have a book, which is actually written for parents and teachers, if you rather read books, a method book, or you find a piano teacher. If you have questions, then you can come back to us if you teach your own child and you're stuck or I have questions from parents.
Again, info@dogsandbirds.co.uk. That's our email address.
Wonderful. Elsa and Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for sharing your love of music with us on The Parents Show.
Thank you. Thanks for your invitation.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And hopefully many children will grow up on Dogs and Birds.
Many more.
Yes. Thank you very much.
We'll take a quick break now on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
So welcome back to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. It's great to have you with us again. I'm Lydia El-Khoury. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Charlotte Southworth, who is the Legal Director for Neurodiversity at Raiden Solicitors. So Charlotte, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And now I'd like to know about your role at Raiden Solicitors.
So I'm a Legal Director at Raiden's. I'm jointly running the St Albans office with Catherine Raiden, Lena Gardner and Che Meekins. And as a sort of addition to that role, I'm part of the ED&I committee, where obviously we look at all aspects of diversity and inclusion. And I have been developing the neurodiversity policy and helping to deliver some internal training on that, which has been really well received. So yeah, it's a good little addition to the side role and the day job of obviously working with clients who are going through a family law situation.
Lovely. And I have to say, I think our listeners would be quite surprised how proactive Raiden solicitors are on the topic of neurodiversity. So it's a topic that's close to your heart professionally and personally a little bit as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I myself have quite mild dyslexia and there's lots of dyslexia in my family. So I have that level of awareness and I suppose additional empathy. I've become more and more interested in the way that various neurodivergent conditions impact on people and their lives, and working, you know, with a huge community of people to try to remove the stigma that attaches to these different conditions. There's clearly a lot of work still to do, but I think, you know, like we were saying, with dyslexia, it seems that people really have got the message. People really do understand that there are such positives that come with this different way of thinking. People tend to be creative thinkers, problem solvers, great with spatial awareness, different strengths that, you know, as long as they are supported and in the right environment, people can really flourish. And then from a client perspective, I think that it's become abundantly clear that the way that solicitors traditionally work with clients is pretty unhelpful for somebody with a neurodiversity. And there's so many small things that we can do, which perhaps we can touch on in more detail, which can make a real difference to people and their experience of going through the process of whether it's divorce or some other family law issue.
Fantastic. So how can a lawyer or indeed any professional take the needs of somebody with a neurodiversity into consideration?
So I think the first and really important step is to speak to them. Obviously, they might not be forthcoming about their diagnosis, and then you won't necessarily feel comfortable opening up the conversation. But where they are, then ask them, what do you struggle with? What can I do that might help? I've got a client I'm working with at the moment who was very helpfully forthcoming. And I said, oh, what might help? Like, is there a colour that helps? And she said, yeah, actually, light green. So all of our emails with her have a light green background. And it's actually helpful from an organisational perspective as well. It's so easily done and it's really helping her. And I think it just acknowledges that we're working together. You know, avoid things like attaching 10 different documents to one email. Can that be turned into one document or sent on separate emails so that there's less of a risk for confusion to arise or for documents to get missed? Talk people through big documents rather than just sending them off and hoping that they can get themselves through all of the detail. Take breaks. Make sure that people aren't getting to the point of being exhausted and overstimulated. I think one of the key messages is when you're working with someone with a neurodiversity on something that is unnatural to them, they're likely to get tired quickly and overstimulated quickly. So try to take breaks and build that into your planning.
Really helpful. And so it's so thoughtful. And I'm sure it makes quite a significant difference to your clients to have those little tweaks and nudges that will just make life an awful lot easier and make the whole process more accessible.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that, you know, especially if it's the first time that you've dealt with lawyers, it can be incredibly daunting. And if you've got to go to court, that's really daunting. So, you know, there are approaches that can be made. It's more and more common for judges to be addressed at the beginning of a day in court on somebody's neurodiversity, so that can be taken into consideration by the judge, firstly in considering how the day is planned out. Do we take a few more breaks? That sort of thing. And secondly, in considering how the person might present in court. Most importantly, of course, if they're giving oral evidence. If they have dyslexia, for example, they might stumble over their words or say something that comes off as strange. But that's just because of their oral processing. It's not because they're lying. And it's really important that sort of understanding is part of the overall case.
And can it actually extend to how family law is implemented? Can understanding for somebody's neurodivergency
Yeah, yes. I think the answer is yes. It will always depend on the judge on the day, as we have to say. And there is going to be a divergence of opinion as to how this should play into the impacts of the law. But the Matrimonial Causes Act, which is the legislation which we utilise for financial matters on divorce, is clear that the considerations should be given to all the relevant circumstances. So if, for example, you have an ADHD diagnosis, that means that you have really struggled to remain in the same place of employment for a long period of time, or struggled to even obtain employment. That's clearly very relevant to your earning capacity, which is a factor that needs to be considered. There might be additional expenses to do with your neurodiversity. Do you have a coach or a special therapy or something cheaper that needs to be maintained? Sometimes people might have a special piece of technology on their computer and that has a cost to it. That all needs to be borne in mind. So, yeah, I think it's the key is in the detail with that, and also in ensuring that it's presented clearly from the beginning of the case so that no one could be suggested to be using it as a tactical advantage. And so, yeah, it's keys in the detail and to just kind of be upfront and honest about it from day one.
Brilliant. And if a parent has a neurodiversity, can that be taken into consideration and can solutions be offered?
Yeah, I mean, I think it might be a case of that being sort of outside of the arena of the court. There's lots of, I hope, lots of assistance out there to be had. But of course, I'm sure that all of the government-provided assistance through GPs, through CAMHS, through Families First, it's all under pressure and there's always going to be a waiting list. We're lucky in this geographical location that we have Space and Advance, which are two great charities working with families to provide them with support. As far as sort of when it comes to the family law aspect and looking at what the child arrangements should be for a separated family, then both neurodiversity, if it is part of the parents' makeup, but also of the children, needs to be a really key consideration. We're looking at what is in the best interests of the child, and unless we are aware of how change will impact the child, how an arrangement which sees them having two separate homes and going back and forth during the school week might impact on them, then we're not helping that child. It's not right that a neurodivergent child be considered in the same way as a child without those different neuro makeups. So I think it's important for consideration to be given and probably for expert evidence to be used. And it doesn't necessarily need to be that there's contentious proceedings before the court for expert evidence to be used. Parents can agree between them to go and instruct a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or an expert in these areas to report to them on how best to support their child.
Because, as you say, even within neurodiversity, there's a diverse community.
Oh, and my, yes.
Every child is different. And indeed, because neurodiversity is genetic, you are probably dealing with one or more parents that have a neurodiversity as well. So, and everybody has a different way of approaching things and different sensitivities, depending where they are on the autistic spectrum, for example.
Yeah, getting that diagnosis really is just step one. I saw a great Instagram video the other day where the lady was stood in front of her hob, and she said that the hob was a really great way of explaining what you're talking about with the spectrum, because you can turn on one ring really high and another ring really low, or in another ring have it completely off. And that's the same with a neurodiversity diagnosis. You might have an awful lot of that particular ring and absolutely none of this other ring/symptom. Yeah. and I thought that was a great way of explaining it. You know, it might be that as a dyslexic person, you actually don't have any difficulties reading, and it's all in the sort of logical processing area. So yeah, really interesting. But yes, definitely not one size fits all.
Yeah, that's what we're thinking. And of course, we're delighted to talk to you on this topic because October holds Dyslexia Week. So it's brilliant to shine a light on that and just increase everybody's understanding of it. Because as you say, I have to say, until a few years ago, you know, some people with dyslexia have no problem reading. I mean, that's a big, it still surprises me because growing up, we had such a kind of image of what dyslexia means. And we know now it's so much deeper and richer and varied than that.
Yeah, I mean, my own story fits that in that my dyslexia wasn't picked up until I was in the working environment because I was good enough at school. And really, it was only, you know, it was only the children who were falling behind academically that would ever be considered dyslexic. But actually, your academic abilities has nothing to do with your dyslexia or any other neurodivergence. You know, you can be incredibly bright and have a neurodiversity.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, increasingly, it's being associated with being incredibly bright now, which is great that we're moving in that direction rather than the kind of old-fashioned stigmas that we've all kind of grown up with. So it's wonderful that children's neurodiversity and parents' neurodiversity can be taken into consideration in family law. And it's wonderful that your firm takes it into consideration, like strategically, by having you in position. So when it comes to family law and neurodiversity, you mentioned we're so lucky to have Advance. You mentioned another organization.
Space.
Yes, I actually have heard of Space. Well, so they're local. And on the national level, you just remind us what there is out there to support parents.
So I think the first stop is usually the GP. And then hopefully you would get a referral to CAMHS. The waiting list for CAMHS is really long, but it is there. The other inroad is via your child's school. And they, I think, can make direct referrals to CAMHS. They certainly can to families first in this geographic location. And so those are the routes to support and to assessments. Of course, you can privately pay for assessments, and there's lots of different places offering those private assessments. So obviously do your research before you buy in. There's the SOAK, unfortunately, that's based in London. They're brilliant for ADHD and autism and everything, really, providing support. And another sort of maybe perhaps more accessible route would be CBT therapy, which I think can be really helpful for children who have a neurodivergence that is causing them to feel anxiety and stress in the educational arena. And you know, working with a CBT therapist as a parent to better support your child as well is a great option.
I mean, that is so interesting. I'm sure that's really valuable for parents too, to bear that in mind, that CBT is an avenue to explore, because divorce and separation it's a tricky time. It's a very tricky time with the best will in the world. But so having all the tools at your disposal makes a lot of sense.
That's right. I think, yeah, going through a divorce is always going to be quite stressful, and there's going to be a lot of change. And I think if there's one thing that we know about children is they don't like change all that much, and they like routine. So the more we can build in a routine where they're able to speak freely to their parent and feel safe to express their opinions, the better they'll be able to sort of just, yeah, manage the change.
And what I love is the openness about it all that you're bringing across, Charlotte. And it sounds like parents and children should not only be absolutely free to raise this with their solicitor, raise their neurodivergent needs, but also be specific. Just kind of, like you say, I like a green background in my emails, or, you know, I've sensory issues,
yeah,
whatever
the
it is.
The more specific they can be, the easier they're making it for us to help them. So, you know, it might be they want us to send them short emails, or that they prefer one long piece of information. It might be that they want to be able to fidget and doodle, and that's how they stay focused, absolutely fine. But you might want to mention it first, otherwise we might be a bit sort of thinking, you know, just to avoid anyone thinking you're not concentrating.
Yeah.
I'm actually doing this to enable me to concentrate.
Yeah.
Fine, brilliant.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, hopefully being able to have that conversation, and you know, ultimately it's up to us to ensure that there's the right level of trust that they feel able to have that conversation.
Yeah, and it starts with openness and transparency, yeah. Doesn't it?
Absolutely, and understanding. And hopefully, you know, if they have sort of dug around on the Raidens website or listened to anything like this, they'll know that they're coming to a firm where there is an understanding and they're not going to be negatively judged for having a different brain process.
It's so refreshing hearing you, and you bring neurodiversity to life and understanding for neurodiversity to life, because I think the fear is always that it may just be a policy that a company or an organization has, but it isn't alive and well, but it sounds like it's alive and well and kicking.
Hopefully. I think that's always a risk, isn't it, that you get the policy and everyone's really positive about having a policy in place and then it turns into a tick box exercise. Yeah. But yeah, we're trying really hard to ensure that that isn't the case at Raidens. We've done internal training and then that continues just to ensure that we're all building on our understanding of neurodiversity all of the time and understanding the value that having different colleagues brings to the business. You know, working in a culture of diversity and difference is great for everyone. And we're just trying to develop that. So, understanding that one colleague might not work well in a situation where perhaps you catch them on the hoof and you quickly dive into a detailed conversation about X, Y, or Z. For some junior colleagues, that might completely throw them and it's not going to be helpful. Pop time in the diary, set a little agenda, and actually you can have a much more productive meeting. Everyone will have the opportunity to bring their best ideas to the table, and you're going to get much more out of the time that you're spending in that conversation. And again, much like the sort of changes you can make to help a client, actually most of the changes are going to be best for everybody. Like, you know, yeah. Oh, try not to have sort of glaring, horrible office lights. Well, I think we'd all rather have nice lighting and daylight in our office, you know. It's just more important for people with a neurodiversity.
Brilliant. Oh, thank you so much, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, pleasure. Really interesting, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raidens Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.